Tommy McNeil. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports Russia is drawing fresh condemnation after strikes at Kyiv's Children's Hospital.
Russian missiles blasted five cities across Ukraine Monday. Officials say at least 31 people were killed. Among the buildings hit the Children's Hospital in Kyiv, forcing young cancer patients to take their treatments outdoors. The UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk called it abominable, noting these were Ukraine's sickest children. Ukraine's Air Force said it intercepted 30 of the more than 40 missiles fired, while Russia denied attacking the hospital and said the strikes hit military targets. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller.
Either side that serve no military purpose.
The assault came on the eve of the NATO summit in Washington. I'm Ben Thomas.
Meanwhile, this VOA's Anita Powell, previewing the summit, tells us that as President Joe Biden welcomes members of the newly enlarged NATO alliance, some critics have put more focus on Biden's age and health.
I'm going to the 81-year-old Biden said he's staying in the presidential race amid a growing list of calls for him to step aside after a shaky debate performance last month. The White House on Monday refuted questions that NATO allies are concerned that these cracks at the leadership level could put the 75-year-old alliance on shaky ground as it leaves to Washington this week. John Kirby is White House National Security Communications Advisor.
We're not picking up any signs of that from our allies at all. Quite the contrary. The conversations that we're having with them in advance is that they're excited about this summit. They're excited about the possibilities and things we're going to be doing together, specifically to help Ukraine.
The alliance meets Tuesday in Washington. Anita Powell, AON News, the White House.
Meanwhile, Hamas has warned that Israel is expanding military operations in Gaza City, and the displacement of thousands of residents could have disastrous repercussions for talks aimed at a ceasefire. This is BYU News. The White House said on Monday it did not expect any change in Iran's behavior after the election of a relative moderate for president. National Security spokesperson John Kirby said during a briefing,
"We'll see what this guy wants to get done, but we are not expecting any changes in Iranian behavior."
Kirby also said that the United Nations, or said the United States, was not ready to resume nuclear talks with Iran under the new president because the country was still supporting groups like Hamas and Hezbollah, as well as the Houthis attacking ships in the Red Sea, and was still supplying drone technology to Russia. Now, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer continued his tour of the UK Monday as part of his pledge for an immediate series set with governments in Scotland, Northern Ireland, and Wales. The new Prime Minister met with the First Minister of Wales, Fionn Gyfnwy, and said that there would be improved cooperation between Wales and Westminster under a Labour government, unlike what he described as conflict with the previous Conservative Party administration.
Here in Wales is particularly important because what I said before the election is that the Labour government will be a game changer because you have a UK government working with the Welsh government delivering for Wales rather than a conflict that I think we've seen too much of over the last 14 years.
After Hurricane Beryl slammed into the U.S. state of Texas, knocking out power to nearly 3 million homes and businesses and killing at least 3 people, it moved east and weakened to a tropical depression. Fast-moving tempest on Monday threatened to carve a harsh path over several more states in the coming days. Officials warned it could take several days to restore power. And the Beryl came ashore as a Category 1 hurricane and toppled 10 transmission lines and knocked down trees that took power lines down. Beryl later weakened into a tropical storm and then a tropical depression. At first glance, elections in France and Britain were a triumph for leftists and reformers over authoritarian and the right. Even Iran, where Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said that the final say on the matters of state elected a heart surgeon, a long-term lawmaker associated with the reformers' government. In France, the leftist coalition beat the far right into third place in legislative elections. The UK's center-left Labour Party swept back to power in the landslide after 14 years of conservative rule. Iranian voters opted for the more moderate of two of the candidates as well. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
A Russian Russian missile hits a children's hospital in Kyiv.
You see what's going on here? No words, even swear words, can describe it.
Russia jails a playwright and director for their play.
The 7-week trial was the most prominent prosecution of Russian cultural figures over their content since Moscow sent troops to Ukraine in 2022.
And will take you to the hottest place on earth.
You know, how many people in the world can say they've been to the hottest place in the world?
Today is Tuesday, July 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. A Russian missile strike hit a children's hospital in Kyiv.
We came here 5 minutes before it all happened. We managed to get to the pediatric ward. I don't know. It is a nightmare.
In a rare daytime attack, Russia launched a barrage of missiles on cities across Ukraine on Monday. Dozens were killed. The scene at the main children's hospital in Kyiv was chaos. People dug through the rubble looking for survivors. VOA's Anna Chernikova was at the hospital after the attack and joins us now from Kyiv. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Yeah, thank you.
So, tell us first what the scene looked like.
Well, to be honest, it's really difficult to comment. It's really terrible scene. The missile hit was in this toxicology department where not just not just patients who were ongoing the different chemo treatments, but also dialysis treatments were located, and seriously ill children. So it makes it even, you know, worse and more difficult to really analyze that. And on the scene, I should definitely mention that so many Kyiv citizens came straight away after the attack to help. A lot of rescue teams, people from the National Rescue Operation departments were on the scene and still on the scene. The rescue operation is ongoing, and a lot of Kyiv citizens are also joining in. You can see many people just in regular clothes without any particular protection equipment or protection items, just helping how they can help to save children and medical personnel from under the rubble, because still there are people in there. And when I was there, when I left the scene, it was announced that medical personnel, a couple of people, and also children were found, rescued, or
they were found alive, but they couldn't get to them.
At this point, we don't know if they are alive or not, but they were, so the bodies were recognized, but still there is still, of course, a hope that they are alive. But to be honest, it's really difficult to imagine how people can survive, because the rubble just really enormous.
This is, Ukraine and Kyiv have been under constant attack. But this has got to be more difficult than most targets to absorb, just because of the nature of the building, children, hospital.
It is indeed, and this is probably why so many citizens came to help. It's definitely, you know, indeed, it's very emotional, very difficult for people, for Ukrainians. No, and I can tell you that the atmosphere in general in Kyiv, particularly where I am, is extremely sad. And tomorrow, it was already announced by the local authorities. So the July 9th will be a day of memory and remembrance of those who were killed and injured in this attack.
Anna Chernikova and Keith, thank you so much for the update.
Thank you.
Moscow has repeatedly denied targeting civilians and civilian infrastructure. However, Its attacks have killed thousands of civilians since it launched its full-scale invasion in February 2022. Joining us now to talk more about this is Matthew Evangelista, professor of history and political science emeritus at Cornell University. So we can't say for sure that Russia targeted either the civilian population of Kyiv or this hospital, but they are launching missiles into populated civilian cities with no apparent military objective. Doesn't international law cover this?
Targeting deliberately a hospital is a violation of the laws of war and has been basically since the beginning of the laws of war. The first Geneva Conventions were adopted in 1864, and they were intended, among other things, to protect medical personnel treating soldiers. The subsequent laws of war, the Geneva Conventions of 1949, for example, had one of the conventions, the fourth, oriented towards the protection of civilians in war. And so attacking a civilian hospital is a violation of that. But it's also a violation, we could say, of customary law. Civilians are supposed to be protected from the harm of war. Not that they would never be harmed, but they cannot be deliberately attacked. And a hospital is a key example of that prohibition.
So it seems that given that parameter, that Russia is violating that at least norm, if not law.
It's violating a law because the Geneva Conventions are part of international law, and the way that the Geneva Conventions work is that they are supposed to be incorporated into the domestic law of the countries that are parties to the convention. So that would be the military law that would then be translated into rules of engagement for Russian troops. So they're violating both international law and they're presumably violating Russian military law if they deliberately attacked a civilian hospital.
Is there an enforcement mechanism for this, or is it after the war when war crimes trials are held?
So the way that the conventions are set up, they're supposed to be self-policing, in effect, of the laws. That's why the Geneva Conventions intend that the laws be adopted into domestic military law. There hasn't been, until recently, an international mechanism for enforcement, except for what you mentioned, if states are defeated, then their leaders could be brought to trial. That's often considered a kind of victor's justice. So in order to overcome that stigma, the United Nations adopted a court to try individuals who had committed war crimes on behalf of their states. That was the Rome Statute that established the International Criminal Court. So there is formally now a court that is intended to hold people accountable who are accused of committing war crimes.
Presumably you attack civilians for the reason of demoralizing, right, the civilian population of the enemy and take them out of the war. Does that work?
Historical experience usually has shown the opposite, that deliberately attacking civilians leads to a kind of rally round the flag effect, a determination, a resilience on the part of the civilian victims. So we saw this in World War II when Germany bombed Britain early in the war. It just redoubled the British commitment to fight. The British didn't learn that lesson, though, and when they bombed German cities, the same thing happened. The Germans solidified behind their regime. The theory behind the bombing of civilians, and there was such a thing. There were a number of proponents of air power, most notably Giulio Due in Italy, but also figures like Billy Mitchell in the United States, who thought that bombing civilians deliberately at the outset of war would make wars severe but very short, and would actually have a deterrent effect, that civilians wouldn't support wars for fear of being attacked themselves. But World War II, which lasted for 4 years with hundreds of thousands of civilians deliberately killed by aerial bombardment, really put paid to that theory, although there are still people in air forces in the United States, in Russia, who think that demoralizing civilians is something achievable, but it's clearly illegal deliberately to attack civilians.
Mm. Thank you so very much for the time. Very interesting.
You're welcome.
Matthew Evangelista, Professor of History and Political Science Emeritus at Cornell University. A Russian court sentenced a playwright and the theater director each to 6 years in prison on Monday. The reason? Well, for, quote, justifying terrorism, unquote. Rights campaigners said the verdict and sentence demonstrated Russia's intolerance of artistic freedom. Here's Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn with more details.
Director Zhenya Berkovich and playwright Svetlana Petrychuk were arrested in May of 2023 over their production of a play about Russian women who marry Islamic State fighters. At the start of the trial in late May, the women said they had staged the play because they opposed terrorism rather than support it. The 7-week trial was the most prominent prosecution of Russian cultural figures over their content since Moscow sent troops to Ukraine in 2022. Both women denied guilt. As the police truck left court, people chanted the women's names. Of course, we will appeal this verdict, although there's little hope. Defense lawyer Ksenia Karpinskaya told supporters.
Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn. We're following these other stories from around the world. Russian President Vladimir Putin welcomed Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi late on Monday, toured him around his residence outside Moscow, ahead of official talks in the Kremlin on Tuesday. A Boeing 757-200 lost the landing gear wheel on Monday when it took off from Los Angeles, but it landed safely in Denver, its planned destination, with no injuries. Brazil has put into effect a free trade agreement with the Palestinian Authority. They've been waiting for ratification of this for more than 10 years. But Brazil says it's a show of support for the Palestinian people. U.S. President Joe Biden is still fighting off questions about his ability to move forward as the Democratic Party nominee for president. On Monday, he appeared on the MSNBC news show Morning Joe by phone.
I'm getting so frustrated by the elites. Now, I'm not talking about you guys, but by the elites in the party who they know so much more. If any of these guys don't think I should run against me, go ahead, announce the president. Challenge me at the convention.
Biden told the hosts he believes that he is still the voters' number one choice.
All the data shows that the average Democrat out there who voted, 14 million of them that voted for me, still want me to be the nominee.
For more on that, VOA correspondent Scott Stearns looks at just what U.S. voters think about the president's continuing candidacy.
The Biden campaign is pushing back against calls for their candidate to step aside following his debate struggles. With $50 million in paid media for July and an aggressive campaign schedule this week, Biden told a Wisconsin rally Friday that he's staying in the race. Voter Sabrina Jordan says he's still a viable candidate.
He should be consistent. He should be I won't say defiant, but somewhere between consistent and defiant, he needs to let people know, and he did today, that he ain't going nowhere, and unless something changes dramatically, he is the man for me.
Voter Jonathan Listag was not so sure.
The physiology that he displayed, he is not the same man. You can't turn back. We're not getting younger. You can't beat old age.
Seeing Biden back on the campaign trail after the debate does not ease the concerns of registered Democrat Ellis Johnston.
I don't feel confident in Joe Biden's ability to win this election, and that makes me very afraid.
For Trump supporters, Biden's sometimes halting debate performance reconfirmed their view that he's not fit for another term. California voter Lamont Pearson.
There's nothing that can come out of Joe Biden's mouth to make me think anything other than what he's already shown me, as well as Trump.
Biden's debate performance is not the whole picture, says Georgia voter Jeffrey Tannarelli.
I think Joe Biden is very passionate and very intelligent. I think he did not perform well because he did not meet the expectations, and his performance was what people expected of him.
That lack of energy leaves Washington, D.C. voter Hannah Savolovich open to a new candidate.
It was kind of clear to me that maybe Biden's not as with it as he used to be, and I think I'd be supportive if someone, they put up another candidate rather than Biden.
If Democrats are to have a different nominee, they need to move quickly, says Michigan voter Alexis Zaidan.
There's a lot of conversations that need to happen within the next, you know, month around what could the Democratic Party do to bring all of its, you know, fractured vote, like its fractured base back to its core and hopefully build strong ahead of November, or we will be looking at a Trump presidency.
Biden's vice president and running mate Kamala Harris would be at the top of the list to replace him as the party's candidate, but that may not work, says California voter Stephanie Bowers.
Kamala would take over, which I would love, but I also think with the world being the way it is, all the prejudice going on, that Trump would probably beat Kamala more so than beating Biden.
Pushing ahead with Biden as the nominee, his campaign has First Lady Jill Biden meeting with military families in three states this week, and the president counter-programming next week's Republican Party convention with remarks in Texas and Nevada. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
The NATO summit that kicks off Tuesday in Washington, D.C., was meant to highlight American leadership and the rejuvenation of the 75-year-old defense pact. But all that was thrown into doubt with questions of Biden's ability to hold the White House against a challenge from former President Donald Trump. Reuters correspondent Zach Goldman looks at the impact that has, that possibility has, on the alliance.
U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin welcomed NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg at the Pentagon on Monday, ahead of a NATO summit of world leaders in Washington this week.
This summit will celebrate 75 years of the greatest defensive alliance in history.
The summit, which kicks off Tuesday, marks the 75th anniversary of the Cold War era alliance.
Representatives of 12 nations of Western Europe and North America assemble for the signing of the North Atlantic Treaty.
The gathering is also meant to showcase the leadership of U.S. President Joe Biden, who rallied NATO allies to show new unity and purpose in the face of Russian President Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine. But looming over what was meant to be a symbol of American-led unity is the potential return to power of Republican President Donald Trump, a change that could upend U.S. foreign policy. The Republicans' penchant for praising Putin and his threats that NATO members needed to pay more for mutual defense have alarmed allies. Worries among NATO allies have grown since Biden fumbled a June 27th debate, boosting Trump in the polls ahead of a November 5th election. That means this week's summit, instead of highlighting Biden's diplomatic accomplishments, will be laser-focused on his fitness to hold office and whether he will still be president in 2025. While much of the attention will focus on Biden amid growing calls within his own party to step aside, the delegates will have a full agenda focused on military and financial aid for Ukraine and offering some pathway toward its eventual NATO membership.
Reuters correspondent Zach Goldman. VOA's in major national edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman.
We all have one unified dislike, and those are those pesky New York City rats.
New York City Mayor Eric Adams. New York has such a big rat problem that Mayor Adams has actually created the position of rat czar in his administration.
They're getting more and more bold. They no longer run from you. They just hang out and just do what they want.
Adams on Monday wheeled out the metropolis's latest weapon in the war against rats, a plastic trash bin.
When I go abroad and when I visit other countries, they are blown away that we still use plastic bags.
They do. It's not uncommon to drive around New York City and see piles of plastic garbage bags stuffed with trash lying on the sidewalk waiting to be picked up. And it's not just that the bags make it easy for the rats to tear into the garbage. It smells bad. Mayor Adams says by November, the city will have containerized 70% of its trash, which, by the way, amounts to 14 billion pounds a year. And finally,
you know, how many people in the world can say they've been to the hottest place in the world?
Death Valley National Park, along the California-Nevada border, is proving once again to be a tourist magnet, with predictions it will officially be the hottest place on Earth in the coming days.
Yeah, so hottest temperature ever recorded in Death Valley was 134 degrees, and that was in July of 1913.
134 degrees Fahrenheit is 56.5 degrees Celsius. And because it gets so hot there, tourists are flocking to the place to be a part of it.
I mean, I know the last time it hit 134 was 1913. And just to be, like, the next one, I just thought it was so cool. I had to bring my nephews, too.
I take a weird sense of pride in it, like being, like, an adventure.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for being with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd J. Austin III previewed a new military assistance package for Ukraine as he met recently with Ukrainian Defense Minister Rustam Umerov.
I am proud that the United States will soon announce more than $2.3 billion in new security assistance for Ukraine.
The aid is designed to provide Ukraine with essential resources at a crucial juncture in the war. The package will provide more air defense interceptors, anti-tank weapons, and other critical munitions from U.S. inventories, said Secretary Austin.
It will also enable the United States to procure more Patriot NASAMS air defense interceptors, which will be provided on an accelerated timeline by the resequencing of deliveries for some foreign military sales.
The U.S. and Ukraine signed a 10-year bilateral security agreement underscoring U.S. support for Ukraine in building and strengthening its defense and deterrence capability over the long term at the G7 summit in June. As President Biden said, a lasting peace for Ukraine must be underwritten by Ukraine's own ability to defend itself now and to deter future aggression. The United States has not wavered in the commitment to ensure Ukraine's security needs are being met, despite Russia's continued invasion, said Secretary Austin.
Ukraine is in a tough fight and has been ever since the start of Putin's reckless war of choice. Kremlin continues to intensify its bombardment of your cities and civilians.
Secretary Austin praised the skill of Ukrainian forces in their continued efforts to fend off Russia's attacks with grit, ingenuity, and courage. the United States' commitment to Ukraine remains strong, said Secretary Austin. Alongside some 50 allies and partners, we'll continue to provide the critical capabilities that Ukraine needs to push back Russian aggression today and to deter Russian aggression tomorrow.